of stick with two ends wrapped with the something the white and white and soft, and you can just put it on the sensor and move it slowly, and don't put too much pressure on it. You're gonna have it clean, but you gotta be slowly moving, unless you want to go to $75 additional kit, and then you could do it. Sometimes it may cost even $100. Enter XGN.
Well, I don't remember exactly, but I think the kit that I purchased was something more like $16. You can always look it up and tell you, but it's not that expensive. They're not made out of esoteric. The tools are made out of plastic. They're disposable. I would feel more comfortable using something that's sort of designed for that shape rather than kind of using what I have available, especially since it's very easy to screw up sensors. Again, if the camera is on its last legs, if you want to be real experimental, you know, you could go for that. I would probably invest the $16 and get the disposable swabs and the liquid and just be cautious and careful.
Well, one more thing is, which I did myself because I've read it on the internet and it works perfectly. If you have an old art brush, clean but old, and start cleaning your sensor, the brush should be used by artists, but it could be designed also for the DSLR sensor cleaning, and it is pure uncoated, and first you put it on your hand, swipe a few times on your hand, make sure that nothing pops out of it. You're gonna have a perfect job done without any fluid. Enter XGN.
Yes, Rich. By the way, I looked it up. It's selling at Amazon. I bought it a couple years ago. It's selling for $19.99. It's 12 swabs and about 15 cc's of cleaner fluid. It's called the VSGO DDR24 DSL or SLR camera full frame sensor cleaning kit, although it works just as well for non-mirrored cameras.
Are you talking about Q-tips and a bottle of denatured alcohol?
It's not quite a Q-tip. If you go to the Amazon site, it's a piece of plastic that's shaped more as a kind of how would I describe it? It's kind of a semicircle, kind of a circle cut in half with a handle and absorbent material covering that semicircle. So it's a little bit easier to just do a nice, clean, one-time sweep through the sensor rather than going back and forth. I mean, ultimately, you could do it yourself for cheaper, but it depends upon how inexpensive and what risks and what you have available and your sense of expertise in the subject. So, Rich, you wanted to say something on the subject.
Was the original problem spots on the film?
That is my understanding.
Also is in the same place.
Say again?
Are the spots always in the same place?
I would hope so, but we'll ask Craig. Craig, do you find that these spots that you're picking up probably on your sensor is in the same location?
Well, I tried using something at least to get to the sensor, and then there's less, but usually they're in the same spot or so. But I did a couple of things, and they actually moved around a little bit.
Does your camera have a dust reduction system?
I don't think so, just the wind reduction.
Well, have you tried brush with a blower?
That would be the worst you could do.
No, I don't have that.
Yeah, that's kind of like moving the stuff around. You probably don't want to move it around. You just want to get rid of it. And the reason that Rich was asking these things is if it showed up at different times for different photographs, if you didn't do anything, then it could be something completely different. But the fact that you try to do something with the sensor and the little bits of dust just kind of moved ever so slightly still keeps it most likely that you just have dust particles covering up little pixels in your sensor. And for that, you know, blowing air through it, unless you can filter it out, because usually those things have their own amount of dust in them. So, again, I would tend to err on the side of using something that's designed for sensor cleaning. But, you know, again, people have been using other things. You know, it depends on the individual. Some people like to be creative and not to pay any money for anything.
Is your camera has in the system menu the mirror lookup or sensor cleaning? Yeah, the reason I asked this question is because I have DSLR cameras, so they use the mirror system to allow you to frame your photos through the actual lenses, so when the camera is not actively engaged in the process of taking the photo, you can look through the eyepiece and then system of mirrors shows you what the sensor will see through the lenses. When you take the photo, the mirror flips up and the light shines on the film sensor instead of into the mirror and up to your eye. So in order to clean the sensor, you need to get a mirror out of the way. And most of the cameras they have, in the menu, they have mirror lookup or sensor cleaning. And there will be a specific instruction for the camera how to do it. So you can press the shutter button to lock the mirror up and to lower it down when you're done. Enter here.
Confused. Is this a film camera or a digital camera?
This is a digital camera. Again, we're kind of going off someplace. Craig already knows how to lock up the mirror, at least my understanding of his description. Pretty much all cameras have some means to lock up the mirrors. Some of them have a vibrator that cleans the sensors. Others don't have vibrators. So at the very least, he can lock up the mirror. It's just a matter of dealing with the dust on the sensor once you've gotten to it. But Rich, getting back to your question again, it's a digital. It's a Rebel T5.
Before I put any liquid or chemical on any sensor, I would take one of those bowl-type squeegee things or squeeze things where you squeeze out the air. There are some of them that are pretty powerful. And I would see if the dust moves around like that. If the dust doesn't move around, or whatever it is, we're just calling it dust, I would, I would go to the last resort of buying a kit like you have, Roy, but I would also be very leery. There may be some dead pixels you're looking at. Go ahead.
Well, it is possible dead pixels, except that Craig mentioned that when he finagles around the sensors, he thinks that they do move a little bit, so moving dead pixels is probably not real common with dead pixels. So I don't know if I would suggest blowing air into the damn thing, because those air blowers can have dust in them. They're not really designed for things as small and sensitive as sensors, so you're just kind of spraying it with stuff that it's picked up before the last time you used it, and I don't know if that's useful. I think that probably makes things a wee bit worse.
wouldn't it damage the sensor if you did that?
No, I mean, if you sprayed it with canned air, yes, it would damage the sensor. But puffing it with a puff of air, it wouldn't damage the sensor. But I think ultimately, unless it was a very special device, it would just kind of shower it in little dust particles, making it worse than it was before.
I would probably assume, obviously, do not try to use an air compressor on the sensor.
Definitely not.
Yes, there are a lot of things that you shouldn't use an air compressor or canned air on, and one of them is certainly a high-resolution digital camera's sensor.
Yeah, actually, it's, talking about T5, 18 to 55 millimeters, 239 dots. It has a TFT 3-inch LCD, color display, and 18 megapixels, APS-C mount for the lens. It's not terribly expensive, but if you like it or you have a sentiment or you have some certain emotional approach to feelings to that camera, then yes, spend extra $50 and you have it done.
Okay, thanks Wes, thanks Rich. Craig, I hope everyone gave you things to ponder and think about, how much you want to be involved in possibly repairing it or giving up on it, or what have you. So I wish you luck, no matter which choice you finally make.
WTVZ, last comment?
Yeah, certainly, Rich.
I learned this the hard way, and most people don't know it. Air compressors have oil. They are run with a little bit of oil, air compressor oil, and mixed in with the air that's coming out of that compressor is a certain amount of oil. So, air compressor user beware. WTVZ.
Yeah, there's lots of fun stuff in a compressor. There's oil and there's water. Two things you really don't want. And even if you could do without them, the cans of air, which are not really canned air, but actually a liquid with a very low boiling point, and it just boils into a vapor, gives you too much of a force. You don't want to fix it with that type of a force. You got to be gentle with the sensor, unless you want to really damage it.
It is always important how you treat your hobby. The hero between DSLRs was Nikon D600, which is now available on eBay probably for $200-$300. But this is amazing at the camera, and I would rather suggest to get to something at the higher level, because this could actually give you a lot of new experience with how to shoot photo. If you are into a photo, video is nice, but nothing special. You got to understand that the Rebel T5 is only 1080p, nothing special, and you have a 3 frames for continuous shooting if you want to press and hold. So it's nothing really that you would be worried about when you're cleaning it. And to XJS.
Okay, Wes, thanks for your suggestions to Craig. I was just trying to address the question that Craig had. Is there anything he can do. It's his lot to decide whether it's worth the effort or to move on to something higher spec. All the major photography companies are with new products. Unfortunately, a lot of them are not compatible with Craig's DSLR. They've changed the lens mount, the new digital cameras, so I don't know how many other lenses he has, but that's a factor too.
82 OGB, I did have an 18 to 50. Something happened to it, so I just have a 55 to 250. If I do this, I could probably hold on to it a little longer and maybe forego getting a smaller camera, but eventually my new biggest camera is going to be the 5DS.
Interesting choice. They're rather expensive, aren't they?
Oh, get a load of this, Roy. Normally on Amazon, you really want to get the whole thing. If you want just the body only, try $1,000 on eBay.
Well, look, guys. Honestly, what can you expect? $3,499. That would be your 5DS. Which is full name is Canon EOS 5DS DSLR camera body only. The word is getting out of mirrors. Right now, the new and best is mirrorless. So, you can get your dream EOS 5DS DSLR camera body only for half of the price. If you're lucky, used, and still, that would be not the right choice. But that's my opinion only.
Well, you look at eBay. I found one for about $1,100 or so. I've seen one once as low as $970. Even the 5DSR, which is a lot more money, I've seen that for as little as probably like $1,000. Now, that you have the special filtering effect. I forgot what it's called, but yeah, that's the 5DSR. I just want the 5DS.
Yes, the 5DS is $3,499 new, and you can check it on B&H. But depends what you're expecting. You can have amazing camera that could cost $7,000, and it will be for photo only. It will have a feature for video, but you got to understand that there is a difference between video and film. And some people are interested with film, not video, or not automated camera, but actually camera with manual zoom. And those cameras could cost as much as $100,000, which would be not even much. There are plenty of ARRI cameras that are in that price. Let me drop. Let's say I have a camera which is EVA1, and it's Panasonic. Amazing camera. It new was $7,435. It doesn't have an autofocus. It has one push autofocus. So it depends what you're looking at and what you're expecting from the camera. But people buy it for the film look like. So it has a algorithm that could form the picture, the RAW, if you want to have a RAW, and then that RAW goes to the program, and that program could make it absolutely the way that you want, that you desire. And to actually...
Okay, I don't know if the point of this segment should be to convince Craig whether he wants to go mirrorless. I will add my two cents worth and say that even the major companies, Canon, Nikon, Fuji, have all kind of steered towards mirrorless cameras. One of the big benefits, among others, is that it does away with the mirror and improves the amount of data available on the viewfinder, and it's a useful additional feature. So you might want to just kind of clean up the sensor on your present camera, use it for as long as you can, do some detective work and find out what's the best price-performance ratio for you, what specs you need, what specs you don't need, and go from there.
Definitely do that. Now, here's the main reason why I want the 5DS. It is a 50-megapixel camera, and that is super. If you look at the photos, it takes that high of a setting.
Interaction. Quickly. The eye cannot see over 18 megapixels. I mean, cannot see the difference. What you're actually getting is 50 megapixels when you crop it down. Or let's say you crop it down. Then all of those pictures are still present. They are not lost. So the picture of the same but lower quality would be looking much better. So let's say the people have a 8K camera and then it's resized to 4K. The 4K is much better than 4K camera that has 4K sensor instead of 8K sensor just because of the pixels that are being loaded into 4K when shrinking. It's not shrinking, it's rather resizing. But your eye will not look at it differently. So if you don't tell the person which picture is better, and he is not a photographer, he would not know. Now, talking about $3,500 spent, yes, it is a luxury. Enter exchange.
Okay, Craig, let me just ask you this question, which hopefully will clear some things up in my mind. With this camera, do you principally do 99% photography, 99% video, 50-50%? What would you say you're roughly looking at for this camera that you do?
And thank you, everyone else. NetControl, AC2GS, KD20GB.
Okay, Craig, unfortunately, we doubled. I just wanted to get a better idea of what you use your camera for. Do you use it for taking pictures, or do you use it for taking videos?
Photos only, but when I get these two new cameras, the SL1 I want to use strictly for video, maybe photos here and there, because I want to do what's called multi-angle video shots, and then the 5DS will strictly be used for photos.
Okay, I just wanted to point out that as far as pixel numbers, as far as video to a degree, yeah, you everything is downsampled to lower progressive lines of pixels. But in photography, it also depends upon whether you... If you crop things in camera, then you probably, unless you're going to print up a picture that's going to go on the side of a truck, you don't need all those megapixels. Although, you know, my camera has 61 megapixels, so who am I to say? But it gives you an opportunity to also crop sharply. If you don't like the way that the photo looks, you can cut it in quarters and still have more than enough pixels to fill up an 11 by 14 piece of paper. So it sort of depends. But, you know, Craig, you know, you're a smart kid. You look at what the options are available, what the prices are available. I understand there is a value in buying stuff that used to be expensive but is now a lot less expensive. But then that usually means there's a reason why it's less expensive, in that the companies that built it are moving in a completely different direction. And that's about as far as you're going to go with that model. But, you know, you decide for yourself.
A few words, because I believe I'm really good in film, if you don't mind.
Sure, Wesley.
Okay. So you have two things. You have a video and you have a film. video is taken by video cameras or in camcorders, and film is the same camera, but it takes film. And what is the difference between film and video? The look. So Ruben has a look, the Arri has look, and Panasonic line of cameras, they have a look. That would be Sony that is trying to feed, but Sony is all mostly for professional youth guys, and they don't need movie. Let me just. Now you have a $3,499 for Canon EOS 5DS DSLR camera body only. And you have $1,200 for the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema camera, 4K. And in film, we're not talking about pixels. We're not interested with pixels. We're not even taking into consideration pixels. We operate in different form of value describing the value and parameters. And that would be K. That would be resolution. So, for $1,200, you have a camera that Canon EOS 5DS DSLR cannot even come close. And you have a free of charge, a Blackmagic packet, a software, DaVinci Resolve, that you can download and use it today. If you want to have a professional version, which would be studio, you pay either $299 or $399, I don't remember exactly, but I have it, and it's a program that is being used by Hollywood studios for their films. Okay, the next camera in line of Blackmagic is Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 6K, which will be BMPCC6K, Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 6K. Now this one used to be $2,500, now is $1,999, and you can have it new. But if you like, you can have that camera or the other camera for much less. So 4K you can buy for $900, $1,000 used, and 6K, unfortunately, you can have maybe maximum of $100 discount. And those cameras, they don't have autofocus, because they have one time push focus, and that's it. But and they are made well, the 4/3, the 4K has 4/3 lens, don't go to it with it, because then the adapter for it would cost you another $400. Better off is to buy 6K, and that will be ready for EF mount lenses. And EF mount lenses are everywhere, there are plenty of it, they are cheap, and you can have them used. And I have a farm of them. So my few cents about it is, since you have a software for free and you have a camera for 1/3 of the price, why to go for Canon EOS that can shoot video, not film? And then film look is done in the software, because Blackmagic Pocket Camera, Pocket Cinema Camera, both of them, the 4K and 6K, can shoot raw.
The sensor is key. Let's go to the next topic.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Okay, very good, Wesley. Well, Craig, again, I wish you luck. We could take up years and years discussing photography, camera models, different versions, and with different goals and such. There's 10 trillion YouTube dedicated to the subject, so I wish you luck on that.
I got plenty of tricks up my sleeve. I'll be doing a lot of researching and writing up text documents. NetControl AC2GS, KD2OGB.
Okie doke. Well, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator of this, the Limewire Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. If anyone has any other questions or comments or topics for discussion, because we still have 45 minutes before the SpaceNet report, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, then maybe we can try a puzzle. I hope people are interested in puzzles. This has something to do with mathematics, but I assure you, if you think it through, you don't really need to use much in the way of mathematics. It's a question basically about a piece of cable. I figure what could be more amateur radio than a piece of cable. So the premise is the following, and you can see it written out in my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, but I will recite it here. You basically have a length of cable that's 80 feet long. It's stuck on two poles on either end. On one pole that's 50 feet high, on the other pole that's 50 feet high. Now, it droops in the middle, and it's approximately 10 feet off the ground at its lowest point. So the question is, how far of these two poles have to be to have it droop just 10 feet above the ground?
KD2NVB.
Yes, Bob.
Well, I looked at the puzzle and I know the answer. Do you want me to let some other people guess, or should I just go ahead with it?
Well, we'll try one other person. My guess will be that the people interested enough to read it are interested enough to solve it. But is there anyone else who would like to hazard a guess?
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
I don't know if you turned it over to me. Did you turn it over to NY2H?
Yes, Lou. I turned it over to NY2H.
All right, so NY2H just wants to say, thinking it narrowly, with dealing with hyperbolic cosines, that leaves no room for error. No room for error. Try that without... See, I'm trying not to be a spoiler. That's my comment. I know the answer, too.
Okay, very good. And yes, Lou is quite right. This is an actual curve that has a name. It's called the catenary. And I will give you a link on the Wikipedia. It is not exactly... It sort of looks like a parabola to me, but it's not really an ideal parabola. It's a structure which by you can only define it by using a hyperbolic cosine function, which is way too much math for this tech net tonight. So this is just a kind of a trick question, and let's see if obviously two out of two people know the answer. Well, if I count me, three out of three. So anyone else want to hazard a guess?
WS2N.
Okay, Paul, I know you too know the answer.
Yeah, that's why I'm going to sit it out. But listening.
Okie doke. Anyone out there who doesn't think he absolutely positively knows the answer, I guess, should be the question. Okay, very well. Obviously, all these gentlemen have realized the trick of it. The point of the exercise is alongside, I said there wasn't going to be that much math, and I mentioned that these types of curves require using hyperbolic cosines, so there's got to be a trick in it. And the trick obviously is if you consider that the 80-foot cable is suspended on one side 40 feet and on the other side 40 feet, the only way that it can go back and forth is if there was almost no distance between the pillars. So the length of the pillars, as Lou hinted at, is zero. So it doesn't require a hyperbolic cosine function. The answer is that the distance between the pillars in this case are exactly zero. But because I apparently got some interest in a math question, let me ask you a little bit more difficult, somewhat esoteric, and I don't know if this is going to go good or bad or indifferent. Ellipses. We've all seen ellipses. Ellipses are very important for many, many fields of endeavor. You could say that electromagnetic propagation is ultimately different forms of ellipses. Extreme cases being circular polarized and linear, but also has to do with a lot of astronomy and orbital mechanics. We're all orbiting in ellipses, not perfect circles, no matter what Plato and Aristotle wanted it to be. Now, ellipses you can sort of think of as a generalization. You can think of them as having a major radius and a minor radius at 90 degrees to each other. So that's the biggest distance from the outside of the ellipse to the center of the ellipse is the major axis, and the minor axis at 90 degrees is from the shortest distance from the center to the surface of the ellipse. Let me drop for a second. So if you think of ellipses like that, you can think of a circle as just having a major and minor axis that are equal. So instead of it being A and B, it's R and R. So it makes some sense because if you really think about it, a circle, the area of a circle is pi R times R, whereas a area of an ellipse is pi times A times B. So, makes sense, right? Now, the circumference of a circle, as we all know, is pi times r plus r, or pi times 2r. So my question for the audience, if you'll so help me, is can you think of any simple analogous equation for the circumference of an ellipse? Now, it's a very useful value because, you know, you're doing a lot of orbital mechanics. So is there anything easy, is there an easy equation for the circumference of an ellipse?
Whiskey 2, Z Fox, portable.
Yes, Whiskey 2, Z. Say again your call sign, please.
Yeah, Whiskey 2, Z Fox. It's Bob in Regal Park.
Okay, Bob, what do you have to say?
Well, I'm just going to take a complete guess here. Circumference of an ellipse, I'm going to say pi times the square root of a squared plus b squared, where a and b are the major and minor axis of radius.
Okay. Anyone else with any ideas of a simple equation to exactly define the circumference of an ellipse?
BDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I'm going to take a guess at pi times A plus B, major axis and minor axis, pi times A plus B. Right?
Okay, we'll write you down for that. Anyone else with any ideas of what the circumference of an ellipse is? What about you, Lou? You're kind of our math whiz here. Okay, once again, if anyone has any idea, Bob and John had very interesting answers. Wonder if there's anyone out there who would like to offer their suggestion.
KH2NBB.
Yes, Bob.
I'm going to guess that it's like, 2 pi r would be the, of course, the circle. So 2 pi times the average of the two. So, like, you know, A plus B over 2, whatever it is, you know, times the average. That's my guess.
Wouldn't that then just be A plus B?
Yeah, I guess it would be. All right, so maybe not. All right, forget it.
Well, there's nothing wrong with it, Bob. It's basically, you just offered John's answer, which is a good answer. I appreciate the effort. Anyone else with any ideas on this subject? Again, the perimeter or circumference of an ellipse, something that you assume NASA uses every day. How do they get it, and where is it? So, any ideas? Feel free. Okay, the unfortunate reality is, as far as mathematics is concerned, there is no simple formula for the perimeter of an ellipse. There are approximation formulas, and one of those approximation formulas are what Bob and John mentioned, pi times A plus B. It's off by about, I think, 3 or 4%, but it's close. The problem is that the actual solution to the equation of the perimeter of an ellipse requires you to integrate ellipses, and integration of ellipses require infinite series. So you have an infinite number of numbers that add up and converge upon the perimeter of the ellipse. So you can only really do an approximation for the perimeter of an ellipse, depending upon how accurate you want it to be. But you can't give it a simple number. Well, let me drop for a second, and I'll give you a little other thought into the subject. The thing that kind of amuses me is we sort of take for granted these other equations that I've mentioned, the pi r squared and the pi 2r. But if you think about it, you have the same exact problem with the number pi. We give it a symbol, we give it sort of a value, but it too is something called a transcendental number. There are rational numbers which can be defined by dividing one integer by another. There are irrational numbers that cannot be defined by dividing integers by other integers. But then there's this special class of numbers that cannot be simply written as equations, like the square root of 2 can be very easily written as the square root of 2. The number, the square root of 2, is an irrational number that goes on forever. So, in fact, all of these equations are approximations because there's no absolute number for pi as well. So that's probably why you have that problem with the ellipse, in that they're all approximations. None of them are exact equations. So I thought it might amuse people to think in terms of that.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
I think I remember hearing somewhere that the exact time of swing or period for a pendulum, if it's making large swings, has to be worked out as an elliptic integral, that it works okay as an approximation for small swings, but if it's a pendulum making very large swings, that it really gets very complicated as an elliptic integral. I remember hearing that somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of functions that have this problem, that they have no exact, rational number, discrete number. And so anything that unfortunately ends up being a integral of an ellipse is always going to be solved by an infinite series of numbers, which, just keeps on going. There are infinite series that resolve to simple numbers. There are, one-half plus one-fourth plus one-eighth plus one-sixteenth plus one-thirty-two to infinity, finally approaches and equals 1. But in the case of the type of elliptical integrals, it doesn't work out that way. So you have to do approximations. So that's my puzzles for tonight. I hope you kind of enjoyed going on the little travel through my brain, what I find interesting and not. Once again, I will ask if anyone has any questions tonight. They don't have to be related to amateur radio. They can be science-related. They could be COVID-related. I don't know if Fred KE2QR is with us tonight. He had a question a few weeks ago. So if anyone has any other questions, please feel free. Okay, we'll go back to good old science talk. I have a couple of articles that I would like to offer you people, and you're free, as always, to ask any questions or make any comments after the story. So I'll let it drop for a second and start you with our first subject for tonight. Okay, pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca formally announced this past Wednesday that its Phase 3 trial in the United Kingdom testing out a vaccine for the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 was put on pause following a report of a serious adverse event among its participants. More details concerning the report have since emerged, but there are still many unanswered questions about whether this incident is truly connected to the vaccine. This past Tuesday night, Stat News reported that the trial was suddenly put on hold due to adverse events, thought it wasn't immediately clear exactly had happened. By late Tuesday, other outlets reported that the event involved a United Kingdom woman in the treatment group who is thought to have developed transverse myelitis. That's a neurological condition characterized by inflammation of the spinal cord. On Wednesday afternoon, Stat News reported that AstraZeneca CEO Pascal Soria told investors earlier in the morning that the woman has been hospitalized with serious neurological symptoms, but she was already recovering and could be discharged as early as that day. In its statement addressing the hold, the company said that a standard review process has been triggered, leading to the voluntary pause of vaccinations across all trials to allow an independent committee to review the safety data of a single event of an unexplained illness that occurred in the United Kingdom's Phase 3 trial. Let me drop for a sec. Transverse myelitis is a rare condition that affects motor and sensory function regulated by both sides of the spinal cord. Though the symptoms associated with it aren't always evenly distributed on both sides of the body. These symptoms include pain and weakness of the limbs, trouble controlling your bladder and bowels, and sensations of numbness or tingling. The majority of the time, there's no clear cause for the transverse myelitis, but it's often been linked to a wide range of infectious diseases such as Zika, West Nile, and Lyme disease. Given that we know about the condition, it's certainly plausible that the woman's symptoms could have been caused by the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is being developed in conjunction with the University of Oxford. But right now, it's simply too early to know. Though adverse events reported during a clinical trial are often seen as synonymous with the treatment side effects, the term is more limited than that. It just means that these symptoms appeared while someone was taking the treatment. They may or may not be related to the treatment. It's only after further investigation, typically by scientists not directly involved in carrying out the research, that we can more clearly tie an adverse event to the drug or medical device being tested. According to Stat News, this isn't the first time that a potential red flag has shown up during one of AstraZeneca's trials for a coronavirus vaccine. During the investor call, Soria reportedly revealed that a trial was put on hold sometime in July after a male participant began developing neurological symptoms. The man was eventually diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and his case was deemed to be unconnected to the vaccine. But no single virus has emerged as a clear cause. Transverse myelitis is sometimes the first sign of what later is recognized as multiple sclerosis. Let me drop for a sec.
A spokesperson for AstraZeneca told reporters that a final diagnosis for the woman has not yet been made and that more tests will be carried out. An independent safety committee will review these tests and determine her final diagnosis and whether it is connected to the vaccine. This same independent panel reviewed the earlier adverse event and ruled that it was unrelated to the vaccine, according to AstraZeneca. Demoralizing as this news may be, it's also an indication that the clinical trial process is working as intended. This is possible, that its possible complication was noted seemingly almost immediately after it happened is a good sign that researchers are keeping a close eye on the volunteers. If this illness does turn out to be related to the vaccine, that's also something for researchers working on other COVID-19 vaccines, especially those similarly based on using a neutered adenovirus as the delivery method for the vaccine dose, to look out for in their studies as well. Unfortunately, clinical research is rarely a smooth ride, and there's a wide margin of failure for potential treatments, even for those that make it to phase three. The last stage needed to secure approval by government agencies like the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Of course, fingers are crossed that this isn't the case. As for the woman at the center of it all, her prognosis for transverse myelitis can vary widely. People do recover to an extent within the first 3 months, though two-thirds are still left with moderate to severe lingering symptoms. The faster someone is diagnosed and receives supportive treatment, such as steroids and physical therapy, the better their outcome is generally thought to be. Let me drop for a sec. The pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca said this Saturday that it had resumed its coronavirus vaccine trial in Britain after suspending it 6 days ago over potentially safety issues. But its trials in the United States and other countries are still on hold, according to them. A spokesman for AstraZeneca said that the company could not disclose any further medical information about the sick volunteer. So, as I've mentioned before, real science is often very messy. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
And Y2H.
Yes, Lou.
All right, yeah, so I saw those reports, the transverse myelitis. I guess there's white and gray matter in the spinal cord also, but it gets inflamed. And they showed the nerve, sensory and motor nerves, coming out of the spinal cord. When it hits that, I guess it's multiple sclerosis, and I think the myelin can get affected also. I'm wondering if they have a an additional case, if that'll just stop everything, because, you know, one-off, apparently she was not in the control group, I guess, otherwise it'd be a moot point. You know, if they have a second case, because she did mention a fellow with the neurological situation also. So I guess this vaccine is using protein or from the spike. And I guess if there's some similarity in DNA between what that looks like and maybe some natural parts of our spinal cord or whatever, maybe you get that reaction. So so I don't know, but I would suggest if there's a second instance, you know, I guess that would become much more statistically significant. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the more people that pop up, but unfortunately, we're dealing with a relatively small group. You know, this is just sort of the beginning of phase three, so I think there's something like 3,000 test cases out there. And so that's terrible odds. If you can't come to any kind of conclusion of any other cause for this neurological disorder, obviously they've decided to go on and evaluate further. But you know, thankfully, on the flip side, there are over 100 different types of vaccines being evaluated as we speak. In addition to the types of protein that this vaccine worked with, this vaccine kind of was modified from a previous one that uses some adenovirus for some reason. I forget the exact history, but the reason why it's come up so fast is that it was something they sort of was working on before even the coronavirus. So they were able to modify it for a vaccine for the coronavirus. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. They've frozen the studies as far as anyone knows outside of the UK, and we'll have to see what further studies show. It's that's the problem with vaccines. Some vaccines are wonderful, some vaccines are terrible. We all pretty much hopefully remember the swine flu vaccine, where people were given a dubious vaccine, and people developed neurological deficits as a consequence. Any other questions or comments about this particular story?
AC2PL.
Yes, Jeff.
Hey, good evening, Roy. Could you make a general comment on the difference between an adenovirus-delivered protein therapeutic as opposed to the Moderna version RNA type therapeutic?
Well, I wish I could. I never really got into the nitty-gritty details. The point of the Moderna vaccine that makes it different than a lot of the others is it basically is using not proteins of the antigens of the virus. It's not provoking antibodies to the spike proteins, as far as I'm aware, but it's actually taking fragments of the RNA that constitutes the coronavirus and using that to induce antibody formation. I think that the Oxford vaccine is a much more traditional one that that works on simply antigen receptors to proteins that are common within the coronavirus.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that attenuated viruses have not been used as extensively in the recent past. That then, really, I think there is a call for them. Just one comment is that the Moderna RNA viruses, I think it would really be the first RNA, vaccination would be the first representation of that class of drug. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. That's the good point and the bad point. It's good because on a theoretical basis, once you have the gene sequence, which China published on the internet back in January, you can go about synthesizing something. The down point, as you mentioned, is that if this is effective, this will be the first known effective vaccine using this technology. And I don't know, I would feel a little bit more comfortable if it was the third, fifth, or the seventh, rather than the first. So although theoretically it should kind of work, no one's bothered to actually prove that with a vaccine that's been produced specifically to imbue a person's immunity of anything.
Yeah, Roy, I agree entirely. And I mean, I was actually quite frankly shocked when they said they indicated that it was safe and effective. Because I had no idea how the RNA was actually getting inside the cell to be translated by our cellular machinery. So, I mean, when we do that in the lab, as you know, we end up making competent cells or electroporating the cells in order to get any sort of DNA or RNA inside. Anything that's negatively charged has a difficult time passaging our kind of strange bilayer, which is negatively charged on the outside and the inside, as you know. Go ahead.
Yeah, I kind of understand the underlying theory that they're working with. I don't know the extent of them having proved it. I assume they proved it in some way in a petri dish, because I definitely know they haven't proven it with any production of any vaccines known. But again, this is just one out of 100. We know about it a lot more because it was easier to do. It may pan out. I wouldn't even hazard a probability. It may not. I don't know. I haven't seen much of any kind of documentary evidence for the progress in these vaccine studies. Unfortunately, the pharmaceutical companies